It's a word you probably talked about in school, learned in school. Thinking about ourselves as sort of the unique primary foundation of humanity, us as individuals. John Verbeke, one of the guys that I've been in dialogue with for quite a while, and he was at the Thunder Bay Conference, he has a question that he'll ask students about meaning in life. What would you want to continue to exist even if you, as an individual, weren't here? Now, he tends to ask that in a secular context to secular students, and they wrestle with that question because we're used to thinking ourselves as individuals, standalone, me and mine. But because most of you are Christians, you probably have a pretty good, healthy list of things that you are invested in. And you're thinking, okay, I might not be here 10 or 20, 30 years from now, but I want this thing to be here. Maybe my church or my denomination or God's kingdom or a whole bunch of things that you are invested in, that you participate in, that you sacrifice for financially or your time, that give you meaning that goes way beyond your individual life. For the last few weeks, I've been talking about sort of nature religion versus escape religion. And if you'll notice that many of these things are individual things. If you were born to the right people, at the right time, in the right place, if you work hard, watch your addictions, don't get sick, use your brain, educate yourself, take care of your body, gain wisdom, then maybe you will win in a lot of different ways in life. And then there's escape religion. Maybe I get to go to heaven, or I can escape the cycle of rebirth, or I can resist attachment. It's about me. And then in our modern world, a lot of our escapist religions are sort of entertainment-based. I want my me time where I get to watch my show and have my hobbies and play my games and do the things that I want. And drug addiction is perhaps one of the most unique individual escapes, where I'll sacrifice almost anything around me just so I can have my relationship with my drug. And that gets into these sort of these nature religions and escape religions, seeking hidden knowledge for success. What do I need to have? What skills do I need to have so that I can succeed? And I'll be a part of relationships for as long as they meet my needs. And I'll have a romantic relationship until it no longer seems to fit what I want. And it's part of the reason people are marriage rates over the last 3 or 4 years, in fact, have plummeted, because a lot of people are saying, well, I can have a romantic or a sexual relationship with someone, but as soon as it doesn't work for me, I'm out of there. But yet there have been some indications in the last few years that maybe some of these much longer ideas have not really receded as far as we might have imagined. When a few years ago Notre Dame Cathedral caught fire, it wasn't that a whole group of people suddenly didn't have the space to go to church where they went every Sunday. In other words, you know, if living stones burned down, a bunch of us would be dislocated. Maybe some people in the community would say, oh, you know, I kind of miss the church on the hill. But for the most part, there wouldn't be. The United States would marshal its resources and have a big conversation about how to put the building back the way it was. That likely would not happen. And just recently, with the death of the Queen, suddenly, it's a rather odd thing in America, which of course fought a revolutionary war so that we would no longer be under the English monarchy, with the number of people paying attention to the funeral and lauding the Queen and her family, I thought, I wonder if Americans had to have a vote to somehow, you know, put the Queen or, I don't think people like Charles as much as they liked her. People think differently about it now. It's not just another building, and it wasn't just another funeral. A number of weeks ago, I preached about the logos of the cross of Christ. And the theme statement of the book of 1 Corinthians, I think, is 1 Corinthians 1:18. For the logos of the cross is foolishness to those who are perishing, but to us who are being saved, it is the power of God. We talked about, now that word, if you open up your English Bibles, it'll say usually for the word of the cross or the message of the cross, because they're struggling to translate that Greek word logos. It's the same word that's in John chapter 1. The word became flesh. The logos became flesh. And that's because that word had a very long history in Greek philosophy and religion before it was used by Paul and by John in the New Testament. Our word logic comes from the word logos. It's sort of an interpretive thread that takes multiplicity and complexity and gives it a rational order and a pathway to pursue. It's the logic of the cross. And of course, everybody in Rome understood the logic that the Romans had of the cross. The logic was, if you're an enemy of the state and we want to make an example of you, whether you're a runaway slave or a rebel, we're going to put you on a cross. And some of you remember that old movie Spartacus that was about a slave revolt in Rome of Spartacus, and how the Romans lined a road with 500 crosses, all with people who revolted against them. And they would leave people on the cross, not just for an afternoon, but often for days and weeks. And it would be, they put it on the places where almost everyone would drive. Here in Sacramento, you would probably put it downtown over where 50 and 80 and 5 all come together so that everyone would see the logos of the Roman cross, which was, if you cross Roman power, we will crush you. And what's more, we will torture you, we will mock you, and we will take you down, your reputation, your body, your family, everything. Paul said in chapter 2, we do not, however, speak a message of wisdom among the mature. Many in Corinth thought themselves to have arrived because they had learned complex philosophy or fancy words or special spiritual practices, and so they considered themselves the mature. But not the wisdom of this age or of the rulers of this age who are coming to nothing. Now, those are just sort of vague generalities. I often have the cover of Tom Holland's book, Dominion, in my sermons, and it'll come a little bit later. But if you want to read an earlier book about who Paul is talking about, the rulers of this age and their wisdom, you can read an earlier book of his called Dynasty, which goes into the Julian-Claudian dynasty with Julius Caesar and Augustus Caesar and Tiberius Caesar and Caligula and then finally the house ending in Nero, who would eventually kill Paul and Peter. These are the rulers of the age, and they had a way of operating, and it was the logos of the Roman cross. And everybody understood who was on top of the world order, because they imagined that they themselves, of course, were not only blessed by the gods, but they themselves were gods. And Paul says that entire order is coming to nothing. And if you had asked anybody in the 50s, the middle of the first century AD, is that entire order coming to nothing? They'd say, no way. Nero is in charge. The Julian Claudians are in charge. They rule the world. And Paul says, nope, they are coming to nothing. No, we declare God's wisdom, a mystery that has been hidden and that God destined for our glory before time began. None of the rulers of this age understood it, for if they had, they would not have crucified the Lord of glory. The Corinthian church has been working their brand of nature religion to become the mature, or the complete, or the ultimate. But there was something new that was revealed in the logos of the cross of Christ that has always been there, but was not plainly seen. It was clearly not understood by the rulers, or they would have changed their behavior, which they didn't. And in fact, of course, Nero would be the end of that house, and after Nero fell, you would have a succession of Roman Empire of emperors for centuries who would usually take the throne by killing the previous dynasty. And that is how, in fact, the rulers of this world work. This is what we speak, not in words taught us by human wisdom, but in words taught us by the Spirit, explaining spiritual realities which Spirit with Spirit taught words. The person without the Spirit does not accept the things that come from the Spirit of God, but considers them foolishness and cannot understand them because they are discerned only through the Spirit. Now that sounds very esoteric and very mysterious, but if you look at it very concretely in the cross of Christ, it suddenly makes sense, because what Jesus did on the cross made no sense to anybody in the world at the time, but for us, it seems, in fact, completely reasonable. The cross will not become a symbol for Christians for centuries to come. It's only in the 3rd or 4th century that Christians begin to use the cross as a symbol to represent themselves, because before that, no one would ever use it as sort of a source of pride. Can you imagine a teenager going to school, or maybe you can, with a little golden electric chair, a cross hanging from her necklace, or maybe a little noose? You would be sent home from school if you went to school with a little golden noose hanging around your neck. It's that sort of scandal that the cross had. But all of this changes with Jesus. All of this changes in terms of the spiritual imagination of the entire world. Why is it that slowly but surely, after the dawn of Christianity, the ubiquity of animal sacrifice disappears from the world bit by bit? In John, we remember when Jesus said, "He must go so that his Spirit must come." And we see the coming of the Spirit, in fact, in the cross of Christ, and the change of understanding of that cross. This practice of your well-being at my expense seems utterly counterintuitive if your religion is about getting from 0 to 100 with the most power, the best experiences, the most money, and the most success. All over the world, people would say, "I like my messiahs uncrucified. I would like my messiahs to be winners." Even today, many Muslims look at the crucifixion of Jesus and say, "No, something happened there, because God would never even allow a significant prophet to suffer public shame and humiliation in such a manner." But this is exactly what Paul is comparing. The way of the Julian Claudian Roman dynasty to Jesus, who to everyone in the world seemed their victim, as Paul is saying, in the middle of the first century, Jesus, in fact, has dethroned the way of the world on the cross. And in the first century, the Corinthians listening to him probably thought, "This is utter foolishness." The person with the Spirit makes judgments about all things, but such a person is not subject to merely human judgments, for who has known the mind of the Lord so as to instruct him? Paul takes a quotation from Isaiah 40. So if you go back and you read Isaiah 40, it says this: "Who has measured the waters in the hollow of his hand, or with the breath of his hand marked off the heavens? Who has held the dust of the earth in a basket, or weighed the mountains on the scales and the hills in a balance? Who can fathom the spirit, ruach in Hebrew, the spirit of the Lord, or instructed the Lord as his counselor?" Paul takes that verse and changed spirit, ruach, would have been pneuma in Greek, and puts in mind, nous. And then he finishes the sentence with, "We have the mind of Christ." Again, it sounds so esoteric. It sounds so strange. But Paul, if you read him again and again, will keep telling the Christians, you need to have the mind of Christ. And you might say, well, what is the mind of Christ? Paul articulates it most clearly in a song in the book of Philippians. in your relationships with one another, have the same mind, nous, as Christ Jesus, who being in very nature God, did not consider equality with God something to be used to his own advantage. Rather, he made himself nothing by taking the very nature of a slave. Being made in human likeness and being found in appearance as a man, he humbled himself by becoming obedient to death, even death on a cross. Therefore, God exalted him to the highest place and gave him a name that is above every name, that at the name of Jesus every knee should bow, in heaven and on earth and under the earth, and every tongue acknowledge that Jesus Christ is Lord, to the glory of God the Father. There is the mind of Christ that is exemplified and borne witness to and comes out publicly at the cross, the logos of the cross of Christ. Brothers and sisters, I could not address you as people who live by the Spirit, but as people who are still worldly, merely infants in Christ. If you think about what a baby is, I know we love to look at babies and say, oh, babies are so innocent. Yeah, they're innocent of some things because they really haven't had a chance to get into too much trouble. But they are completely and annoyingly selfish. When that infant is 6 months old and has a need, they will cry until they get their needs met. When that baby is 2 or 3 years old in the nursery, they will fight like crazy with the other people that are there. They do not have the mind of the Spirit that Paul is talking about there. And Paul is basically telling the Corinthian church, you're acting like a bunch of toddlers. Now, you're all grown up toddlers, and you're fighting over status and hierarchy and who knows what and who's more advanced than the other. But you're basically like a bunch of toddlers fighting in the nursery with each other over who has the best toys. I give you milk, not solid food, for you are not yet ready for it. Go ahead. What do you tell it? What do you tell a toddler? Have the mind of Christ. Is that what you tell a toddler? What do you tell a toddler? Share. That's all the toddler can understand. Share. You start there. So Paul is saying to them, I'm going to talk to you like I talk to toddlers. Share. Let's start there, okay? Because this other stuff that we read about in Philippians, you're not there yet. You are still worldly. You act just like a Roman emperor. For since there is jealousy and quarreling among you, are you not worldly? Are you not acting like mere humans? For when one says, I follow Paul, and another, I follow Apollos, are you not being human beings? Are you not acting like Roman emperors? Are you not acting like politicians bickering with each other? Are you not acting like all of the little office intrigue in your office that can't all come together on the same page to get the job done? Paul is saying you're completely worldly in your relationships with one another. And that's abundantly clear in your community. What, after all, is Apollos? And what, after all, is Paul? Only servants through whom you came to believe, as the Lord has assigned to each his task. Now, what Paul is going to do is give us two metaphors, two images, and both of these images are to draw our attention beyond the individual into something higher that individuals can come together and participate in. I planted the seed, Apollo watered it, but God has made it grow. Now we're talking seeds, still individuals, but he's about to take this metaphor and make it larger. So neither the one who plants nor the one who waters is anything, but only God who makes things grow. In other words, if you're going to plant a field, you need seed, someone needs to put in seed. You need water, someone's going to have to manage the irrigation. It's too bad Jack's not here, because Jack was always here to give us illustrations of irrigation and planting. And if you ask Jack to go out to the farm, he would love to walk through the process of growing rice with you. But the point is not each individual plant. The point is the field, the harvest, the crop. And Jack would be the first one to tell you, we measure the soil, we work on the conditions, we do all of this, but we only make the situation, and it's God who brings the growth of the plant. Same thing is true in church. We try to have a good situation whereby you can come in, but it's only God who brings the growth in you, and it's only God who brings the growth in the church. The one who plants and the one who waters have one purpose, but they will each be rewarded according to their labor, for we are co-workers in God's service. It's not about Paul, it's not about Apollos, it's not about Cephas, it's not about us as individuals, it's about the communal effort that God uses to take all of this together and create a field. And then Paul switches metaphors. A building. Now, all of these images are about the one and the many. You have a part to play here. And actually, I was bragging to someone about this church because you're really hard-pressed to find someone in this church that doesn't have a part to play in this church, partly just because it's so small. If you can warm a glass, we will find a job for you. And we will press you into service because we need your help, because there aren't that many of us. And everybody has their part to play. So, you know, if I'm not here, well, you can get a pinch hitter preacher to come in. If Rick's not here, we're not going to have screaming. If Roger's not here and Jared's not here, I don't know who's going to flip slides. If the deacons aren't here, we can't manage the money. If the elders aren't here, we're not going to have communion. I mean, on and on and on and on, but it all goes together into one thing. It's the one and the many. It's the individual pieces and then the complete picture. And then Paul now switches metaphor from a field to God's building. Well, what would God's building be? It would be the temple. By the grace God has given me, I laid a foundation as a wise builder. Paul was there first, planting the church in Corinth. And someone else building on it. Cephas came through. Apollo came through. But each one should build with care, for no one can lay any foundation other than the one already laid, which is Christ Jesus. He went first with the logos of the cross of Christ. There's the foundation. If anyone builds on this foundation using gold, silver, costly stones, wood, hay, or straw, their work will be shown for what it is, because the day will bring light. Now you might notice, right there in the text, day is capitalized. The editors of the NIV have done that because they are aware that Paul is referencing this day of the Lord tradition that I speak about often. It's a tradition in the Old Testament, comes out of the book of Joel. The day is the day of judgment, when we will see, in fact, what the quality of the church has been. We have testing day if you're at school, and we will see if you've learned anything in class. You have evaluation day at work when your boss looks at you and says, we will see what you have accomplished. And Paul says, every church has a day in which it is tested, and in that day, the quality of that church is seen and known. It will be revealed with fire, and fire will test the quality of each person's work. It's like the three little pigs. You get a house of straw, a house of wood, and a house of brick. And the day is sort of like the wolf that comes. But if what has been built survives, the builder will receive a reward. If it is burned up, the builder will suffer loss, but yet will be saved, even though only as one escaping through the flames. One of the things after visiting Europe I noticed is that if you want to build something that lasts, build it beautiful. Why? Because if you build it ugly, probably 50 or 100 years, the building isn't going to suit anymore. They're going to look at the building and say, this isn't worth anything anymore. Tear it down. So we'll tear it down. But if you build it beautiful, they'll look at it and say, the AC doesn't work so well, and it wasn't wired for electricity or anything like that, but it's so beautiful. Let's keep it. And so Paul says, everyone who comes along and adds something to it, builds part of it, and then what you have will be tested. Don't you know that you yourselves are God's temple and God's Spirit lives in your midst? Now, Paul's writing this in the 50s, which means that the temple in Jerusalem is still standing. Paul is making a rather audacious statement here because he is saying that the people in Corinth are where God's Spirit lives. Now, again, that sounds so esoteric and abstract from us, but if you think about the logos of the cross of Christ, if you think about your well-being at my expense, if you think about what Jesus was communicating when he was being crucified, that, you can think about it as an idea, but it's much more as a practice. If that practice is living here between the people, remember when I talked about having the mind of Christ? If living out of that mind of Christ is happening in this space, then Christ's Spirit, seen on the cross, is at work in that space. That's exactly what Paul is saying. And if it's at work in that space, then you are God's building. You are God's temple. Peter will make the same point in 1 Peter 2. Christ is the living stone, and you are the living stones out of which a temple is being built. If anyone destroys God's temple, God will destroy that person, for God's temple is sacred, and you together are that temple. There's a couple of other ideas that are really important in here because we don't have a sense in the modern world of how temples functioned in the ancient world. If you read all of the descriptions of the tabernacle, very carefully you begin to realize tabernacle was set up to be sort of a little Garden of Eden. And then when you look at the temple in Jerusalem, the temple was set up to be sort of a microcosm of the cosmos itself. That's what temples were. And what Paul is saying is that the church, when Christ's Spirit is functioning in the church is to be a tiny little microcosm of the way the world is supposed to be. Now, what Paul says here about destroying the temple is a curious thing because, of course, the Babylonians destroyed the temple. Were they judged? Well, the Persians would come and judge the Babylonians. And then the Romans would destroy the second temple in 70 AD. Were the Romans judged? Well, where are the Romans today? And the idea, however, is that in all of those transformations, when the Babylonians destroyed the temple in 586 BC, what happened was, because the Jewish communities could no longer meet around the sacrificial offering, they started synagogues all over the place. And then even when the temple was rebuilt under the Persians, those synagogues endured. And they met around the Torah. And those synagogues became sort of the nucleus out of which the church would spring. And then when the temple was destroyed a second time, guess what? It has never been rebuilt. Why? Because the practice of sort of locating everything in stone moved into locating everything in people. Sort of like a field is something that can live on for 100 years, but all of those individual plants may only live for a season. A building, one of the things that I noted when I visited a bunch of churches in Europe was often they would build a tiny little building, and then as the village would grow, the building would grow and grow and grow and grow as the community would grow. In other words, the building sort of became a quasi-living expression of the far more living people that lasted only a season, like one individual rice stalk will last only a season, but a field of rice will last far longer. Do not deceive yourselves. If any of you think you are wise by the standards of this age, according to the Roman emperors, you should become fools so that you may become wise. Fools like Christ, who was seen as a fool. For the wisdom of this world is foolishness in God's sight. As it is written, he catches the wise in their craftiness. And again, the Lord knows that the thoughts of the wise are futile. So then, no more boasting about human leaders. Oh, I know Paul better than any of you, or I know Apollos better than any of you. All things are yours, whether Paul or Apollos or Cephas, or the world or life or death, or the present or the future, all are yours. Paul is saying, you will inherit the earth. It's exactly what Jesus says in the Sermon on the Mount. And you are of Christ, and Christ is of God. Paul is saying, you will inherit the earth. Now you might say, well, that sounds kind of funny, except the fact that when I read Philippians 2 to you about this self-donating ethos, whether you're in church on Sunday morning or not, you can go out into the world, people can call themselves atheists, but if they imagine themselves to be a good person in Western culture, they will tell you that is good. A Roman emperor would have said, that's idiocy. You all have been part of a project of civilization that has been building on the logos of the cross of Christ for 2,000 years, which is why when Notre Dame caught on fire, whether or not people were actually going to church in France, they looked at that building and said, we have to fix it up again. Why? I don't know, but we have to. And what all of this does is bring to mind a truth that you possess but can't articulate. A cathedral like Notre Dame took 200 years to construct it. The people in the community didn't know exactly what or why they were doing it. Well, this is just what we do. And then they built it over a couple of hundred years, and it's been around for 800 years longer. And it's going to continue to be around because France, whether or not it's Christian, won't look at that building and say, it doesn't matter. One of the videos that I made this week about a conversation with Edie just mentioned, she saw my talk with Tom Holland, another guy who's sort of in the middle of where Tom Holland is at, is a guy named Douglas Murray, who's a journalist in the UK. And he's wrestling with this idea because he looks around and he says, culturally, I've come to imagine I am a cultural Christian. But if it's just a cultural Christianity, it doesn't have much staying power because you need actual living, breathing, committed Christians to actually renew the culture, to practice out that logos of the cross of Christ. And Douglas Murray is sort of in the place where he says, I don't quite believe. I sort of want to believe. I want to believe in the resurrection, but I don't know if it's reasonable. I don't know if I can. There's so little in our secular society often now that people work towards communally. Ask people all the time, should you be part of a community? Oh yeah, I think so. What are you willing to do to have it cost you? Well, not much. Well, then you're not going to have much of a community. Why? Christianity offered a vision of the future as a participatory collective, a field, a temple. And this meaning crisis is the result of people having little to strive for beyond themselves. I just want to have a comfortable little life and leave me alone. Well, you're not even going to get that. The logos of the cross of Christ seems like foolishness, yet symbolically it's seen all over the place. Every good mother sacrifices her life for the future of her children. Every good father sacrifices his life for the future of his family. Every good generation sacrifices its short-term benefits for future generations. We see this as good because Jesus gave of himself, exactly as Philippians says. It's built into our culture now, into our traditions, and it all started with Christ. And his spirit has been moving through time, yet each generation has to take it and say, I don't want it to just be in the buildings, I want it to be in my life. It's embedded in cultural traditions, but we don't even recognize it as religious. So the question is, what will you do? Will you take something that is a theoretical idea and make it actual in your life by living into it, by taking the mind of Christ that's displayed on the cross? Do you see Christ's kingdom as a temple, as a field, as something you can participate in? Do you see your life as something that has significance far beyond this earthly record might bear witness to? One of the things that strikes you when you go into these churches in Europe is you find all of these stones and things in the walls, and sometimes even back the graves of people in the church. And in a sense, they're marking and saying, I was here 500 years ago. These are my people. This is my place. I invested in this place. But every successive generation must make it their own. How do we do this? Well, Christ as field, Christ as temple, Christ as body. On the night he was betrayed, he took bread and he broke it. And right here you see the manifestation of the Spirit of Christ in a startling new way that takes his disciples by surprise. They're expecting the rehearsal of the Seder, of the Passover celebration, of the lamb that gives its life for the family with the blood on the doorpost. And Jesus now steps into the place of an animal and says, this is my body, not the body of an animal that didn't have any say in the matter, but my body. And I who has say in the matter, I take my body, and my body will be broken for you. Every mother who has given birth knows that body is broken for the child. Every parent who struggles for a child knows their body is broken for that child. And Christ says, I alone, as your God, my body will be broken, not just for a child or a family or an office or a city. My body is broken for the world and for all of you, not just the individual stalks of rice, but for the field, for the building, for the temple.